Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Saturday, July 19th, 2003. Today's session is entitled, Who Will Roll Away the Stone? Stories of Closure, Healing, and Resurrection in Palestine and Israel. Session 5 of Roadmaps and Detours, Stories and Images from 5 Years in the Holy Land, presented by Michael and Susan Thomas, number THM 2003-05. Let's listen in.
We serve the Lutheran Church of the Redeemer in Jerusalem. This is our final session for this week, and what we're going to do is try to allow opportunity for discussion, for questions and comments. We're going to trace quickly where we've been this past week. We've talked about the wall of separation yesterday. We talked about the roadmap on Wednesday. We talked about the general situation or comments. We had a kind of simulated checkpoint on Monday. And today we're going to hear quickly, we're giving you short little news summaries, news that we watched. In fact, we thought they were well done. In fact, that's why we wanted to show them to you by a friend, a correspondent for a British television station called Sky News. And today he's going to interview a person who has a bar named Mike's Place. There's also one in Jerusalem. And Mike's Place was the subject of a bombing in early May. And he's going to talk to the owner of that bar and what the consequences, what the effect was of that bombing. And you're going to get a little taste, a little very quick view of Tel Aviv, which is a very different city than Jerusalem. Then we're going to go to a few pictures, and then we're going to have time to talk.
So,
can someone get the lights? The correspondent's name is Andrew Wilson.
Freddy admitted he refused to work and must keep wide support within Israel itself. Without it, the road to peace will lead to a dead end. The Israeli peace movement, or Peace Now as it's known, was founded in 1978. It rapidly became the primary force for peace in Israel. In 1995, 100,000 protesters attended a Peace Now rally in Tel Aviv, but the Israeli peace camp has been all but completely marginalized. Now their actions are largely symbolic and the numbers have dwindled. Part of the reason for the decline in Israeli support, of course, is the effect of Palestinian suicide bombings. 369 people have been killed in suicide bombings inside Israel since the start of the Intifada in September 2000. One of the latest attacks took place in Tel Aviv when British Muslim Asif Hanif blew himself up outside Mike's Place bar. Sky's Middle East correspondent Andrew Wilson joins us now from Mike's bar.
You find us here in Tel Aviv on the beachfront, lined with bars. The beachfront, incidentally, that a few years ago would have been packed with tourists as the summer heat starts to build up towards June, but now there's only a few locals on the beach and barely anyone else to be seen for obvious reasons. We're outside Mike's Place. 3 weeks ago, on the 30th of April, the bar was packed. The security guard is standing where I am now and was approached by a man packed with explosives, a man we now know to be a Briton by the name of Asif Mohammed Hanif. He detonated his explosives. The band had just finished their first jamming session, was leaning here against the bonnet at the back of the cars, having a cigarette break before going back in to see the other band play. The two members of the band here were killed in the blast, as was a waitress who had joined them to chat while they were taking their break. The rest of the bar, their lives were probably saved by the actions of the security guard pushing the bomber backwards. Mike's Place is not exactly typical, but certainly not unique of Tel Aviv in that it runs a tolerant policy. Anyone's welcome here, no matter what their nationality or race or creed. They come in if they want to buy a drink, listen to the music, they can. It's very close to the US Embassy. A lot of Americans, as a result, come in here as well for a drink in the evening and to listen to the live music that plays most nights at Mike's Place. We're here, obviously, because it's the bar that's been struck by the bombing campaign, but also to look at this issue about whether or not ordinary people, when their lives are touched by the conflict, do they necessarily have to become politicized? In other words, does being targeted make you someone who's going to hate the other side for the rest of July. Joining me now is Asaf Ganter, the owner of Mike's Place, and also the owner of the other Mike's Place in Jerusalem. Thanks for coming in. You rebuilt this bar very quickly after it was hit by the explosion, didn't you? Why was that?
Well, I think the only victory that sanity and peace can have is, you know, life is going to go on, and people have to understand that on both sides you can have as much craziness as possible, but you can't kill life. People are still going to go out, people are still going to party. A week afterwards, we're already here, we're open, and that's the real victory.
Are you in a small island in a world that you see as chaotic at the moment, or what are you standing for by making these gestures? And you keep your open door policy going, don't you?
Yes, you do. I think it's very important that anybody can come in here, you know, and have a beer and to get away from all the craziness outside. But I don't think that Mike's Place is so unique. It's a little bit unique in the fact that it appeals to many kind of different people, and a lot of people come in here from all different sides to see the music. You know, the average person anywhere in the world, especially also in Ramallah, also in Jerusalem, in Tel Aviv, and anywhere in the world, just wants to come home and be with his children and make some money and make an honest living. And it's too bad that, you know, insanity like this keeps it from happening.
You've lost friends in this latest bomb attack. I know you've lost another friend, or he was badly wounded in the Jerusalem bomb at the weekend. Has that changed you at all?
Well, it kind of, your initial reaction is to give up hope, but how can you give up hope? You know, if I'm going to give up hope, I'll just, you know, I'll just close the place and go take a long swim in the beach over there. But that's not what I'm going to do, because you can't. You have to keep on going. That's what we intend to do.
You know, one thing that strikes everyone who lives here or even visits here for a few days is the difference between the cities down here on the beachfront and Jerusalem up there on the hill, those that live far closer to the conflict. We're looking at Tel Aviv this morning, and our first report comes from this city, the city by the sea.
Tel Aviv is a world away from Jerusalem. At once bohemian and businesslike, it encapsulates the original Zionist dream, secular, tolerant, and moderate. Students at Tel Aviv University remain hardcore liberals. They're in a minority nationwide, but should times improve, others would join them.
The problem is with the leaders, with these masters of war in Israel and Palestine. Because I strongly believe that Israelis and Palestinians want to achieve peace.
I feel that all the time this is the condition, right? That the Palestinians prove, the Palestinians show, the Palestinians do, and then after that maybe Israel will. I don't think that has much future.
Tel Aviv is also a target. The bombers, when they can, will hit the hotels, bars, and restaurants. And yet if the Israeli electorate does grow tired of its government's military solution, the movement will probably start here.
This is the talk of the time. We can live together, we speak the same language, we've been neighbors for so many years, and the Israelis are sending a message to Prime Minister Sharon. Mr. Prime Minister, it is time to try now to talk and not just to shoot. Israel was always supposed to be a sanctuary, a place for safety for Jews from around the world. But the past couple of years has taken the shine off that a bit, creating in some the desire to give up and leave, and in others feelings of determination and even hostility. In such conflicted times, clear decision-making is almost impossible. Neil Corney moved here from England 12 years ago. He's a foreign exchange trader. Times are hard and some of his friends are leaving. He's a typical peace voter who lost heart, but he's staying and might be won back.
I've got four boys and they're all going to go into the army. I would certainly really want a situation where they could go into an army that was only protecting the country as any other army in the world, and wouldn't be involved in danger on a daily basis.
Like many Palestinians, liberal Israelis just need a dose of hope and signs that their leaders have found a workable formula for their future, and they will back it. But here in Tel Aviv, the signals they get so far from the front line are confusing. Most never see the West Bank or the settlers or the markets of Ramallah. They only see the bombs. It's difficult to tell them that there are like-minded people on the other side of Ariel Sharon's fence. Over the past 16 months, a new movement has gathered some steam on the Israeli side of things. It's called the Courage to Refuse. Their critics sometimes call them the Refuseniks. soldiers who are quite happy to do their military service, or indeed their 1 month military reservist duty after having done their conscription, as long as it isn't inside the West Bank and Gaza. It means a short spell in military prison, but there are many who are prepared to take it. And one of those people is Itai Shvirsky, who joins us now. Itai, you've got a long military career behind you, haven't you? 4 years regular.
I can tell you, I'm now 28 years old. I served as an officer in the paratroopers for 10 years, for the last 10 years. Four of them in the regular army and six of them in the reservists. Now, this service was very, very important to me because I care a great deal for my country and for the Israeli army. But exactly out of this love and of this responsibility for my country, a year ago, I decided I'm going to refuse to serve any longer. Anymore in the occupied territory.
And what was wrong with service in the occupied territories?
What was wrong there? Actually, I refused because I finally, after 10 years, it took me 10 years, but after 10 years, I finally understood that serving there, maintaining the occupation, maintaining the settlement project, I'm destroying the chance that me, my children, and even my grandchildren will ever live here in peace. My feeling was that we are putting there more and more obstacles for any chance of peace between us and the Palestinians. And I think everybody knows that there won't be a military solution for this conflict. We must talk to one another, and we must not, we must put our rifles down.
Well, Jerusalem has been fought at.
To hear some Jewish Israeli voices. Let me just ask you, how many of you have Jewish friends or neighbors or work colleagues? Okay, a good number of you. And that was certainly true for Susan and me. When we lived in Cambridge, Massachusetts, we worked in university ministry, campus ministry, and we worked on a daily basis with rabbis and Jewish workers on campus ministry and university-wide issues. In the condominium that we lived in Arlington, Massachusetts, we had probably our closest friends, several sets, an elderly couple who had survived the Holocaust, and a young couple, American Jews. They were important people for us, and our children played with the children of the younger family. And then we moved to Vienna, Austria. We didn't know very many Jews, but it was our responsibility there to craft the ecumenical Thanksgiving service. And we had the idea that since it really is, it's not just ecumenical, it's interfaith, to fully lift up that American holiday, we wanted to involve people other than only Christians. And so we involved the Jewish community of Vienna, which had been decimated during the war and was beginning to regrow. And so we were put in contact with various people. And that was a wonderful experience for us to see a community that had really been decimated, had been wiped out, regrowing in Vienna, and then to actually have that community involved in the American Thanksgiving service. So when one of our Austrian friends visited us in Jerusalem, a Christian, when we drove her from the airport up to Jerusalem, we took her on the way to our home on the Mount of Olives, on the other side, so to speak. We took her through Mea Shearim, which is probably the most ultra-Orthodox Jewish community in the world. And she was just ecstatic to see for miles, seemingly miles, ultra-Orthodox people going about their daily lives, wearing, you know, the black suits, the dress of Eastern European Jewry in the 18th century, to see women pushing strollers with many children, because it meant to her that the country that she had come from really had not succeeded in doing what what they had tried to do. And Hitler, she remembered very well, was Austrian. So that was the context that we came out of. And we came into another context. We had talked a little bit about how important context is, what you see from your bedroom window when you open the shutters or draw the curtains in the morning. And our context then in Jerusalem was on the Palestinian side, in Palestinian geography and in the Palestinian context. And so we knew very few Jews. There was a settlement up above us. They were pretty well segregated from the Palestinian community. Both were wary of the other. And so the Jews that we saw, the Israeli Jews we saw on a daily basis, were the police, border police, soldiers, and bureaucrats. And so seldom did we see actions of humanity. There were actions, I mean, that were painful to watch. Jewish soldiers kicking Palestinians, putting Palestinians into the bright, hot sunlight for hours on end. Let me give you a short little story, because you really, if we could sort of frame everything, I think it would be John's. Steve, didn't you say that your favorite text is "Come and see"? Well, that's ours too. And in this context, it's "Come and see and meet Israelis and Palestinians, and just keep your eyes open and your ears open to what is happening around you." Let me tell you one little story. For a Palestinian, say, to go to Jordan, where we saw yesterday that 31% of all the Palestinians in the world reside as refugees, for the most part. To go to Jordan, they need a special permit, and they have to go to the Ministry of Interior. There's a large Ministry of Interior in West Jerusalem, but that does not serve them, or service them. They have to go to the Ministry of Interior in East Jerusalem, the Palestinian side of Jerusalem. And it's this rather small building, and it looks like it's in a war zone. There's heavy metal mesh screening. There are gates that you have to go through, and you start lining up to go there. Many, many times I saw Palestinians lining up at 11 p.m., 10 p.m. at night to get a spot, because they can only take 200 people a day, roughly. And what government in the world, if you have a Ministry of Interior, do you limit the number of people that can come in? It's not just for going to Jordan, it's for everything. Registering a birth, a death, to renew your permit. Every Palestinian or person who lives in East Jerusalem that's Palestinian needs to go to this ministry at least once a year. And it's extremely difficult to get in. So it's not just people that want to get in that are lined up. It's Palestinian kids that will line up and will sell their place in line. So it's a terrible example of civil society, because then you force a Palestinian that most likely, in many cases, does not have very much money, to pay a lot of money in order to get in, to receive normal governmental service. That's the point. It's very difficult to receive normal governmental service that we in the United States certainly have every expectation of receiving. So that's one story. Let's go to the pictures and go through those. Excuse me. Just make the wire connection.
This was a gathering of our congregation in retreat one weekend, and the children had put together this little poster but certainly their concern was for peace in the Middle East as we gather together to be of comfort and courage for one another.
I have lost the track. What I wanted to say was that it's very difficult to, because of where we live simply and the work that we do, and this was very true in our congregation, to get to know ordinary Israeli Jews on a day-to-day basis. And that was, I think, a challenge for our congregation and a challenge that we tried to lift up. And so we were very fortunate and able to meet Jews that were, for the most part, involved either in peace actions, in the peace movement or human rights movement, or had children attending the same international school, an Anglican school in Jerusalem that our children attended. And they were a lifesaver for us. This is Bishop Aniv Yunan, who is the bishop of the Evangelical Lutheran Church of Jordan. It's a small church, has six congregations. It is, in a sense, a daughter of the German Prussian church, which became a kind of combined Reformed and Lutheran church. The Palestinian church, though, is a Lutheran church rather than Reformed. And his office is in the same building where we worship and work as well. This is in our chapel.
We had children, a really regular congregation that we came to in 1998, trying to mostly English speaking internationals.
And they're all gone, and that will be a theme throughout this show. They're all gone. Every one of those children.
This was a farewell and Godspeed, because people came and went so frequently. We would often in the summer, right before many people would be leaving, have a time together where we especially said goodbye to a whole group, and that was one of them.
And this was taken, this is sort of a representative group in our congregation. We had a social gathering at our house. This is on our rooftop. Mm-hmm. And we took a picture, and the man on the left is a chemical engineer student now in France. He is from Gaza. He's Palestinian. The woman that he has his arms around is French, an historian. She came to Hebrew University to study. The couple to their left are from Australia. They were both students. The man is a Chinese scholar, and so when there was an official delegation of the Chinese government, he helped translate when they went through the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. And then Susan and myself, and then Lena and Peter Luf from Sweden. Lena just completed her doctorate in medieval Hebrew studies, and Peter is a pastor in the Lutheran Church of Sweden. I've shown this slide many times before. I used to say, they're all gone except for us. Now we are gone as well. And this is at Farewell and Godspeed just a couple of weeks ago. Our congregation is almost entirely international, with a couple of people, a couple of Palestinians or Armenians, most of whom work in the non-governmental organization sector, and the number of people who work in diplomatic missions.
And I think it's interesting, Lois is part of the U.S. Embassy in Tel Aviv, and she would go to great effort to get to Jerusalem each Sunday, planning her visits to the Knesset or anybody else that she had to.
Because it was not allowed for her to come into the Old City, so she had to find an official policy reason
to Jerusalem on.
And she was the number two person in the U.S. Embassy. And so she made the crossover in the other direction. We had to consciously think, how are we going to work with and be in a relationship of friendship and collegiality with Israeli Jews, and she had to go to the other direction. She speaks fluent Hebrew. She had to come, and so to take her through East Jerusalem at first was, she was a little anxious at first, and that's not unusual. In fact, some people just won't go. She wasn't so anxious, but she was clearly uncertain of her way and how to go. And I have a picture of her also at the same occasion where she's talking. This was when Colin Powell. So she took time out to come. Worship was extremely important for her. She had served in South Africa, and that was what really opened her eyes to the struggle of peoples around the world. And so coming here, she wanted to be part of a community, and she came in on a foot washing service we had on Monday, Thursday a couple of years ago, and she came virtually every Sunday. So I have another picture of her talking to Colin Powell on the phone. She was incredibly busy, and yet this was very important to her. And this is another important group, at least as important as Lois, doing another sphere of activity. These are Christian Peacemaker team members. And have any of you heard of the Christian Peacemaker team?
Yes.
A few. Okay. They came out of the Mennonite, but they are wildly and widely ecumenical now, with Presbyterians and Roman Catholics and Quakers. And for the
Lutherans,
most part, from
Lutherans.
And Lutherans, yes, we have one Lutheran in the front right, Leanne. And they come in usually for 3 month segments. That's another way to come and see. And they live in probably the most difficult, intense place in, well, except perhaps with the exception of Gaza, in the West Bank in Israel. They live in Hebron, which is where there's a very strong, powerful, small Jewish community.
And this is in our home. We had one of the important things that we did in our ministry there was to be a place of hospitality and kind of refuge for people who are coming in. These people would come in again to services on Sunday.
That would mean would be leaving by at least 6 in the morning to come for a 9 a.m. service. And it would only take... If it were here, it would only take you 20 minutes to drive. And then it got so bad that they would come in, if they were able to get out, they would come in on Saturday night. So we had many parties with them. I mean, they live in community. That's how they're able to function. And what was, why they were such a treasure to our community, church community, was that they saw really the worst of Israeli Jews. They saw the very worst. And yet they were often in conversation with those particular settlers and with the wider Jewish peace and human rights community. And so they were remarkably free from bitterness. I have to say that bitterness was the great spiritual temptation in our congregation. And they were remarkably free and healthy. Even though it was extremely difficult work that they did. What they would do is they would walk around Hebron. Sometimes they would walk Palestinian, often, daily. They would walk Palestinian children to school. Now this is why you have to come and see. They would, there's a road and there's a settlement, meaning sort of an apartment building that's heavily guarded with Jewish settlers. And there was a Palestinian school about 45 yards across the way and up a hill from them. And eventually, the settlers stopped allowing the children to walk on the road. It was their road. And so then they had to walk on this dirt embankment. And often, settler kids would throw rocks. This happened all the time. Very seldom did the Israeli soldiers stop them, once in a while, if there were internationals around. And so the CPT team would have a simple ministry of walking children to school and meeting them in the afternoon to walk them back. This is in Hebron. We wanted to transition to Hebron. Hebron, as well as many other West Bank cities, has experienced long periods of curfew. And curfew, probably most of you know, curfew
well,
was not...
I think, just ask, what, is, okay. what's, what would you think of when you hear the word curfew?
You have to be indoors.
Well, at a certain time.
Indoors by dark.
We think of it as for teenagers, you know.
Yeah.
And curfew means you can't go out of your apartment, out of your
you
home.
You just can't go out of your home.
24 hours a day, sometimes weeks on end.
It's locked down.
And here's a man peering from his balcony. As we were internationals. Who can walk around Hebron when there's curfew? The settlers. And now it's actually getting hard for internationals. They're under curfew too at times. Christian peacemaker team. And so we're able to walk around. But Palestinians stay in. That means if
you're... Well, it was also a point. I mean, it was to break curfew. I mean, to try to non-violently resist that.
And I mean, so if you ran out of bottled cooking gas, you simply couldn't use a stove. If you ran out of medicine, you couldn't get medicine. So one of the other things that the Christian Peacemaker team did was bring food and medicine where possible. It wasn't always possible. This is also in Hebron. The Jewish settler movement has tried to expand, and they try to purchase property. And this is the case of a Palestinian that refused to sell his property. And so one day, his vineyard, this is a small vineyard, was burnt, and the vines were all severed, you can see.
It's hard to see, but here you see this. This is the...
And this happens all the time.
Cut.
So, for instance, on Palestinian buildings, Hebron is an ancient city, biblical city. And so you have these three-story buildings where you have these beautiful vine arbors on the roof where people go to enjoy the shade and enjoy the fresh air. And so you have the vine growing up outside, and it's sometimes 4 to 6 inches in diameter. And many times we would come by and we would see that it had been severed. And that's done by the settlers. The settlers will be walking, they feel endangered, they have been shot, they've been targeted for shootings from a hillside in Hebron. So they almost always men have machine guns or pistols with them. And then
there are lots of settlers.
Palestinians do not have, cannot of course have guns and so on. And just to tell you a little story,
some they have are certainly illegal. I mean, they're not supposed to have.
We found a very nice, one of these work tool knife sets, you know, that had pliers and a knife and screwdriver and all that. At church, somebody had left it. So we gave it to one of the workers at church, and he's a Palestinian. He said he couldn't take it because the blade was longer than his forefinger.
It had to be no longer than between his two fingers here so that it couldn't cause fatal damage. You know, so he is a Palestinian. If he were caught walking along the street, stopped along the street, and they found that in his pocket, he would be arrested for having a deadly weapon on him.
This is Pentecost 2000 in Bethlehem, Bethlehem's manger square.
So this is pre-Intifada.
Yeah, this is May 2000, and we're celebrating and dreaming of what might come in this next years, in the next decade. Celebrating. This is April 2003. We're again on Manger Square. With the Church of the Nativity in the background, and this is a small silent peace vigil that we had every Sunday. We would bring people from our congregation and we would meet with Palestinians there. So most of the people are Palestinian, and this is probably twice the number that are pictured.
One of the things that was really important was to look for resurrection and to roll away the stone with church people. And it's unusual for any of these various religious figures, the Syrian, the Greek Orthodox, the Roman Catholic, the Anglican, the Lutheran, all of these various church leaders to be seen in a what would be seen as a political demonstration, and in fact leading one. And this was a...
The march is trying to go from Bethlehem to Jerusalem to go through the checkpoint.
To try to get from Bethlehem into Jerusalem.
We didn't make it.
To lead the people through. It was not successful. We didn't get through.
But it was nonviolent, and the important thing was to involve the church leaders. Probably the church leaders have to take many more risks than they're willing to take now.
They have a lot of privileges and this is one of the realities of society there, is that when you and in any kind of a control situation, when people are divided according to what privileges they have, then they are always afraid to lose them. And so to work together as a community to make change is that much harder. So people who have a Jerusalem ID, who live in the West Bank and can go into Jerusalem, don't want to risk losing their ID for the sake of the others who don't have one. And it's a good way of keeping people off balance so that they won't.
So these church leaders have something called VIP cards. And so it isn't just simply that they like being important people, but it's necessary for their ministry so that they can, for instance, if they're going to speak in London, they need that card to help them get to the airport, to go through the checkpoints. And so it's important, and so they get caught.
Here we have, again, Bishop Munir Yunan of the Lutheran Church. We have Pastor Mitri Raheb of the Christmas Lutheran Church in Bethlehem, and Jadala Shahada, who is the pastor in Beit Jala of the Lutheran Church there, which is a neighboring town to Bethlehem. And here is, some of you know Barbara Rossing, who has been part of Holden Village. She came to visit she has come many times
yeah.
And visiting with Mitri Raheb on the roof of Christmas Church in Bethlehem. Mitri's sister Viola Raheb, who at the time was a director of schools for the ELCJ, the Lutheran Church there. And each congregation basically has a school attached to it, which has been a very
The educational mission
ministry.
Is really important.
And this is their mother, Umitri.
And so this is actually at their home. And one of the poignant things that Mitri said during occupation and bombing last year was as he tried to shelter his two daughters, was he remembers his mother taking him to the Church of the Nativity to shelter him in 1967. Mm-hmm. And he wondered whether his daughters would have to shelter their children in a church because of war. Mm-hmm. I want to take you to Amman, Jordan for a happier scene.
A bittersweet one.
Yeah. Another pastor of the Palestinian Lutheran Church, Pastor Azar, and at a church in Amman. And it's for the wedding of Violet Raheb. She met this wonderful Palestinian man who she met him in Austria, where he lives as a classically trained Arabic singer. And they're getting married in Amman. But I just showed you a picture of their home in Bethlehem. Well, he can't go back. He's a refugee. His parents left from the Galilee in the northern part of today's Israel and went to Lebanon. And refugees are not allowed back. And so they could not have a marriage in her home church. So what they had to do was get married in Amman. And so then this resulted in a gathering of families, the refugee families who lived in his relatives who lived in Lebanon, and those who were still in Israel could come to Amman. Palestinians in the West Bank, Violet's relatives, could come to Amman too, though with more difficulty, a lot more difficulty. They would have to leave at 4 a.m. and try to get to Jericho, which is very close. But it was Jericho is the one city that wasn't occupied by the Israelis, but they had to get through the checkpoint because there's a ditch dug virtually all the way around Jericho.
There's no wall around Jericho now, it's a ditch, you can't.
Yeah, and so you have to go through the checkpoints. And then you have to be lucky enough to get someone to drive you from Jericho to the border crossing, and you have to get there early enough. How many have been to Israel or Jordan? And did you cross at the Allenby Bridge?
Yeah.
Okay, well, there are two terminals, one for internationals and one for Palestinians. And I can tell you that the Palestinians are treated vastly differently at their crossover point. So you can wait, it can take 3 days to cross over. And so the wedding took place. It was a wonderful wedding, an occasion for dancing and singing. He did an impromptu concert that was really beautiful. And so it was a joyous occasion, but then they left for Austria. He was living there. Violet was the director of the schools, very creative.
And their hope was that he would be able to come and be part of this educational system and the cultural life of Palestine with his background in the music.
And so once again, I mean, so many Palestinians are lost to immigration. This is Jaffa Gate in Jerusalem. It's the same way that the Kaiser Wilhelm came in the late 19th century to lay the foundation stone for the Redeemer Church. And this is a security checkpoint that people are going through. The only people that are really stopped are Palestinians. But security checkpoints are not sometimes so much about security. People find all sorts of ways to climb over walls or go around. This was for a museum exhibit at David's Citadel.
So an artwork. Yeah.
This is a checkpoint. I showed this slide a few days ago on the way to Ramallah. And even most people have to walk, but people with the VIP cards that I mentioned, we were part of a delegation, could drive. Permission had been secured. But when we actually got there, no one knew anything about permission. And so Bishop and Eve had to get out. And there was a vigorous argument unfolding here. He was a very strong advocate with these soldiers. And we went to visit the Hope Lutheran Church and the Hope School of Hope in Ramallah, where Pastor Ramez was talking about the incursion into Ramallah. This is April 2002, and the school was closed up. The Israelis came, they wanted to search. They were looking for illegal weapons. So they came to the church and the school. They were locked. Of course, they broke down the gates. They went, and though there were notes on the gates in Arabic and Hebrew and English saying, please call me, I will open up all doors so you can go ahead.
How do you argue with guards at the gate?
Oh,
I mean, aren't you immediately
at the checkpoint?
Well,
yeah,
at
the checkpoint.
You insist. You call your commanding officer. We have permission. Then Maniv gets on the phone. I mean, he's fluent in Hebrew. He starts calling any number of Israelis to say, "Look, I'm having a problem here. You told me I wouldn't have a problem," and they say,
or he calls Lois. He calls Lois, you know.
That's who he really calls. He called. And then, Lois is the woman who is the number two at the U.S. Embassy. He calls her and tries to get her working on the case. and that's probably a difficulty because, you know, how many calls can, if you're trying to get your work done, how many calls like that can you take a day?
How long did it take to get through?
It took about half an hour that time. It wasn't bad, but you had to argue your case. So Pastor Ramez is saying that, well, they did finally get him. They brought him in. They went to his house, put him in an armored personnel carrier, drove to the church. And I want to tell this story. And so then they, because this is something the Israelis deny, then they had all the keys, and they went from room to room, closet to closet, and so on.
So they're searching from terrorists, okay?
Yeah.
The idea is that they're
weapons, especially weapons. Okay, so he opens up a door, and then they open the door, and they push him in, because if there's anyone in there, they want him to be shot and not an Israeli. And that's a violation of the Geneva Conventions in terms of how civilians are to be treated. This happened thousands of times in spring 2002. Every single closet he had to, he was pushed into it. And so there he's showing how the Israelis would point a gun. So finally they're satisfied that there are no weapons, there are no terrorists. They go up to the church tower and they see these canvas tents. And they say, what are these tents? They think military use. What are these tents here for? And he explains, well, they're for the Boy Scouts. Okay, so they're done. Okay, so they go out. It's curfew now. That means that if you're walking on the street, you're Palestinian, you can be shot dead, and that's what happened on occasion. Not often, but it certainly happened. If you were out during curfew, you can be shot dead. And there's snipers, there are Israeli snipers in a number of the tall buildings in Ramallah at this time. And so they say, okay, you're free to go. And it's under curfew. And he says, what do you mean? And he wanted a ride back. And they wouldn't give him a ride back. They said, oh, we'll call and tell people that it's okay. And he had to walk back to his house. And it wasn't far, I think it was half a kilometer.
And that was the point at which he was really frightened, because
the only time.
He wasn't frightened in his church, because of course he knew there was nothing there that was, he wasn't going to, there was nobody there that was going to shoot him.
And where the Israeli snipers were in the apartment of our Swedish colleague, Gustav Otquist. They had broken into that apartment, which was about 10 stories tall and overlooked the school in that neighborhood. And so the Israelis were in the apartment of a Swedish Lutheran colleague. And now I'm taking you to Jenin in 2002. In March, there had been a terrible incursion into Jenin. Many Israelis, soldiers had lost, I think, 23 Israelis, which is, for the size country, is a large number. Israeli soldiers had lost their lives storming the refugee camp. They had been trapped in these alleyways, and it was essentially guerrilla fighting. And so we came on the first convoy organized by churches to come in to Jenin, and people are filming some of the transfer of goods. And what's wonderful is this is a Syrian Orthodox scholar, Father Shimon, and there he has his video camera recording the scene like many other people, like I was. And how many of you have ever worked on a Lutheran quilt? Okay, these are some of your quilts being offloaded and brought into a warehouse.
To be distributed to the people.
And this is Michelle Sabak and a sister and other priests from, normally he isn't allowed, or it's very difficult for him to come up to this area, so he's visiting the Catholic community just outside of Jenin. This is the center of Jenin. It's up there, which was the refugee camp, which was where this heavy fighting was. And in response to the killing of the Israeli soldiers, which they were shot in a war situation. They were not, say, taken aside and lined up against a wall and shot. It was a conflict situation. The Israelis essentially destroyed an area. It's about 150 yards by 150 yards. They completely leveled it. What you have to imagine are lots of three-story buildings, narrow roads and alleyways. And so we came as people were still trying to go through the rubble to find what might have belonged to them. And how, you know, the children, you really have to go, hearts have to go out for children on both sides. I mean, I can't imagine how these children aren't traumatized by having lived through that. what happened was that you had Apache helicopters, which we make, firing cannons and machine guns down in that area. Then you had tanks coming through, but the weapon that is the most fearful weapon for a Palestinian are bulldozers that are made by Caterpillar, a U.S. company, that are armored plated in Israel. And they go through, and what they do is they shear off a wall, and then the building collapses. And so any Palestinian fighter, let alone civilians, know that they have no chance in that. And so what happened in Jenin, this is where civilians were put at risk by the Israelis. A civilian would be a mother, a father, would be forced to go ahead of a group of Israeli soldiers into any of these alleyways, into the apartments. Then once Israelis had gained access to an apartment, they would set off explosives that would allow them to go from apartment to apartment to apartment through the wall. And so it had to have been extremely frightening for the children. But, you know, Palestinian culture is a resilient culture. And these are some of our colleagues that we, this is Rima that worked with us. We work with her. This is our neighborhood. There's sheep grazing back there on the Mount of Olives and some of the school children. This is Samir, a Lutheran Palestinian at his falafel stand in the old city. This is where we often got our plane tickets, at the KLM office in East Jerusalem. Boy, do these people struggle to make a living, you know. And they're very good at what they do. Manuel, the man in the foreground, is very good. That's the new manager in the back, because the old manager, this is the Palestinian story, the old manager decided he had had it. Not so much personally, I mean, he had been frustrated by the checkpoints that took him sometimes 3 hours to get to his work, which was just a couple of miles away. He decided he'll join his brother in LA, who has a very lucrative business making ATM machines. And so on the day that I left Jerusalem and Israel, Palestine for the last time, his family also left, and we met at the X-ray machines. We began Good Friday, Palm Sunday, and I was there to buy palm fronds that were woven into this lovely branch that you could put flowers into. Watching that man was wonderful. And we're marching now down the Mount of Olives towards Jerusalem. The Dome of the Rock is in the upper left-hand corner. And then what was really wonderful about this picture looks a little chaotic. Sandra Olwine is our Methodist colleague, who is an associate pastor at Christmas Lutheran Church. She managed to get a busload of Palestinian Lutherans for Christmas Lutheran Church in Bethlehem for the Palm Sunday gathering, March. That is normally, should not be a problem, but it is always a tremendous difficulty, even though freedom of religion is guaranteed and is generally respected, except you can't cross over. And so these kids have never been to Jerusalem. And Sandra's pointing out, this is Gethsemane, pointing out the sites that are important for the Christian faith. We go to Good Friday, and here it was so wonderful. These are three Palestinians. That's Pastor Ramez from Ramallah, who was able to come in. And here what was so wonderful was that a girl, for the first time in our 5 years there, carried the cross for a part of the distance. As we gather, we can't go into the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which is where the last three stations of the cross are. We walk what's, you know, the traditional Via Dolorosa, the Way of Tears. And so we gather next to our, close to our church, really at the intersection between our church and the Holy Sepulchre. And we had a Swedish American friend visiting us who, as we were doing the Good Friday walk a couple of years ago, noticed the wonderful bread that is put out for sale early in the morning, and it's in the shape of the Greek letter Tau, the cross shape. And so she thought that was a wonderful sign for that day and for resurrection and for the bread of life.
You said you couldn't go into the Holy Sepulchre. What was the
reason? Oh, it's because we are Lutheran and not Roman Catholic.
You can't
and not
come
Syrian.
In as a
procession.
That's processing through as part of
And this is from Easter 2003, sunrise service, looking over the Judean desert. There's a Palestinian village, and if you can see further, you can see a large Israeli settlement. And this is something that is always a highlight each year. And so Sandra Olein from Bethlehem came in that day so that we could share the service. And then I wanted to again mention the importance of crossing over. This is largely a Jewish and international group with the Palestinian family. We're trying to rebuild their demolished house, their house demolished for the third time. And that's a story we have a tape about that we might show at an extra session next week. But it's wonderful. And so coming and seeing, you see a lot of pain, you see a lot of suffering, but there's tremendous inspiration when you see people from three different backgrounds working together in common to try to overcome some of the division, some of the destruction in the land. It's inspiring, and it's very strange to say, but you have to come to experience it. It's fun. I mean, there's a joy that maybe, you know, that God is not going to abandon the Jews and the Palestinians to endless violence. And again, one of the peace gatherings, the silent vigils in Bethlehem Manger Square. And this is the World Council of Churches, which our church, the ELCA, is part of, and the illegal occupation of Palestine. That's their theme for the next 10 years.
Our pictures. If you'd like to turn on the lights, we have about 1 minute.
Well, we can. Yeah. Sorry, we talked again too long, but we'll be glad to talk as long as anyone would like to.
Any questions, comments immediately? Yes.
If you had to pick one position that you two could hold from now and begin the new roadmap, and be the most influential, what position would it be? As Prime Minister of Israel, of Palestine, of the UN, or Britain, US? What position would you pick to make this thing happen? Which one is the most key?
I think I'd be hard pressed to say whether it'd be the US or the Prime Minister of Israel.
It'd be the Prime Minister of Israel.
Yeah, probably of Israel.
I mean, Israel could end this tomorrow. They could say
if you had that position, that would be the most influential one that would make this thing happen.
Well, it's an extraordinarily difficult position to be in. But I guess when I say that, what I mean is that it's in our experience, it is Israel who is the power that can change things here. They are the ones who need to move. In terms of returning to the 67 borders, and they are the power. It's not there's not a balance of power here. They're the ones who hold most of it. And so, in that sense, they're the ones that have to make the moves that are going to actually make the difference.
So, and with that roadmap, I forgot what it said on, there was like six or seven steps on that thing. If they go through all those in good faith, will that get them there? And
it'll go much further. If they do it in good faith, it'll go much, much further than we've gone in a long time.
And are they committed to doing that? Or only in words or deeds? Or?
Well, that's the $60,000 question.
It's not a monolithic society. I mean, some people are committed and others aren't.
And I think it's interesting in terms of polling that Israelis want to certainly clamp down on the violence, but they're willing also to make sacrifices for peace, generally land for peace. And I think that both peoples realize that it's a dead end what has been happening the last 3 years. It's a dance of death, and they have difficulty separating themselves, and that's why the quartet, and especially the United States, can play a significant role. Not to. We've enabled these people to have this dance of death for 50 years now by the way that we have supported Israel.
Yes?
Could a move toward peace by the Israeli government cause a revolutionary backlash within Israel?
From within Israel itself?
Within Israel.
Sure. It's a very contentious society with a very, very widely differing opinions. Whether it would have the, you know, whether, I don't know. I don't know whether it would have the power to stop something like this happening.
I mean, you're going to have religious Zionist settlers.
Sure. Yes.
Extremists are going to be extremely upset.
That
underlies the Israeli societal conflict that's inherent between the religious and the secular. Most people are secular in Israel. But for Israeli Jews, the question of what is a Jew is not a question of whether you go to the synagogue or not. You can be, a Jew can be someone, you know, you say to a taxi driver who doesn't do any sort of outwardly religious things, you know, are you a Jew? Of course I'm a Jew. I served in the army. I say Kaddish for my parents. I do this and this. I am a good Jew. And so the distinction between religious and secular are not so clarifying, but there are two groups. So a lot of Israeli commentators say that the real conflict in Israeli society is not between peace and those who don't want peace or who want more land, but between the religious and the so-called secular in terms of what kind of society are they going to have. A lot of Jews want to be able to buy groceries on Saturday. They want to be able to buy pork even.
So if you're really cynical, you could say that, you know, they could be united against, you know, they need the struggle with the Palestinians to be united about anything.
The author of the Body and the Blood, I'm sure you're well aware of that book.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
You probably meant
there's still, I think, one copy out. It was the Boston Globe.
Yeah, I recommend it if anybody, if you haven't already talked about it, it's a fantastic book. His premise is that the Christian presence is absolutely necessary in that region because Christians understand and can communicate the grace that's needed for the people in the region, and that's an element that's really minimized or even missing between the people who are at war.
Yeah, it's a little bit, maybe a little bit presumptuous to say this, but the forgiveness, the emphasis upon grace and forgiveness that Christians can bring, and the fact that in the culture they have bridged, I mean, in Israel and Palestine, they sort of fall between the gaps as well. I mean, they are a minority within Palestine and a minority within Israel too. I mean, there's conversation.
Now, thank you for that. That's the point that we forgot to mention in this session. Now, I love this term, holy envy, by a New Testament theologian called Christopher Stendahl, where there are various aspects of religion, of each religion, that we can envy, that we don't need to appropriate and make our own and claim and colonize, but we can envy that. I would say for me, it's the Jewish Shabbat, the peace that descends on Friday afternoon. You can feel it if you're in West Jerusalem. It's beautiful. And I can envy it. And I can lift up Shabbat here, Sunday, the quiet here. And for, I think, what maybe Muslims and Jews, again, it's perhaps presumptuous, that they can perhaps envy and is the Christian notion of forgiveness, the concept of forgiveness and the reality of forgiveness and reconciliation. And that's why it's so important that Christians not leave the West Bank and Israel and Gaza, that we find ways that they can remain rooted as they have been from anywhere between 2,000 and 800 years.
And yet many of the most important influences are leaving or have already left. And
yeah, we can talk about the Palestinians that left our congregation to go to the U.S.
But perhaps they are spreading a message where enough of us will get upset about it that the that maybe in a very naive way of saying this may be working for good.
Yeah.
Because each of those who is leaving obviously has a powerful story and is sharing it as you two are.
And many of them, if you can sum up, why are they leaving? Because I don't want my children to grow up in this. They have just had it that they see their. It's almost shameful for parents to have their children see them treated the way they are treated by Israelis at checkpoints. Mm-hmm. Just, an Israeli soldier, border police, just needs to use a finger and can sort of move somebody as if by magic from one side of the road to the other side. I was getting a haircut with a Palestinian barber, and in walked four Israelis, the tax collector to look at his receipts, and three soldiers to make sure that, because they were in dangerous ground, to make sure nothing happened. And it diminishes your humanity when that happens. Other questions or comments?
Those of you who need to leave, certainly.
Yeah.
Can leave.